Good morning. It's so good to see you here today. Hey, my name is Chris Causey. I'm the lead pastor. And I am so excited. Anybody else excited? It's like spring is almost here. Like we may have finally survived winter. Like it is just a good day. That, like, I feel bad for the animals who've kind of sort of been coming out of hibernation for the last month and a half because like a fake spring that we experience. But this is like my favorite time of the year. There's like Easter coming up. There's the egg drop coming up. I mean, it's just like, it's like Christmas all over again. I mean, so it's just awesome. And then you get summer. Speaking of the egg drop, we've had about 4,000 people register for the egg drop so far, which is insane. Yes, isn't that wild? Like we're at that stage now where people are emailing me. And I just feel bad because they're like, it's sold out. Can you please get us tickets? And like my kids have been looking forward to this. And it's like, I don't have that kind of power, right? I don't even run this event. We have an amazing team of people who are scattered among your midst and who are greeting you when you're walking in. This amazing team that has been working for months to put on this event. And so... You don't know their email addresses so that they can't be emailed because they have the real power. So it's one of those things where we're super excited. But here's kind of my last call, because in order for us to create a special moment for thousands of people, right, to do Dedham Disney, right, which is what it's sort of becoming into, okay, to pull it off, we need you. And for some of you, you're like, oh, I'm so glad there are other people stepping up. But this is the week you get to step up, okay? Because in order to pull up, in order to pull off this event, here's the cool part. It would not happen without you. This church puts this event on. This is not like where we serve and we're helping someone else pull off an event. This is our event, which is extraordinary that a church our size can do that, something that big, but it's not that extraordinary because we have an extraordinary God, and that is the storyline of this church. We do big things because we have a big God, regardless of how big we are. And egg drop is just one of those ways, and it's oftentimes the first step in someone's story where they start to rethink who God is because they experience a church that loves without bait and switch and kind of a, you know, there's none of that. It's just like we believe love does. I mean, he did it for us, and we believe that's what we do for others. We love. And so we still need some more what we call experts. Patent pending trademark on that one. But, we give you a free T-shirt, and you get to be a reason that kids wake up next Saturday excited, whether you're inside of an Easter Bunny suit, whether you're doing face tattoos, whether you're helping set up, whether you're the bouncers at the fence, stopping parents from trying to take way too many eggs, right? Like, there is a place for you. Last year, I got to run off people trying to sneak into the back of the field taking eggs, and it awakened something inside of me, because as a pastor, I don't normally get to run, chase down, and scream at people, but this was the day, and so maybe if that's what you've been hungry for, this is your moment, okay? So if you're interested, it's just a few hours on Saturday, April 1st. And so as you leave today, there will be some iPads out in the lobby. If you're joining us online, encountereggdrop.com/volunteer, that if a dozen of you said yes today, it would make the difference next week. Okay? So this is what it takes. And it's incredible. And I love being the pastor of this church. But today I get to wrap up a series called Money Talks. And we've just been in this for the last month, and kind of the big idea for the first few weeks is really that oftentimes money management is about me management. And I kind of set the stage for that, and Dallas walked you through that, and we just kind of looked at this idea of how managing me transforms how I manage my money. That the contentment and self-control inside of me actually will affect how I manage the money in my life around me. And that money is not something that's new to us, right? That we recognized, even as I told you last week, that smart people do dumb things with money all the time. And before it was dollar bills, it was other things like salt, right? I mean, that was where the root for the word salary comes from, is the same root word for the word for salt. But even when people were paid in salt, they still did dumb things with salt. Because the reality is that me management's a hard thing. But that what's fascinating, I came across this this interesting tablet. I'm sure you guys can read that from where you're sitting. It's about 4,000 years old. It's comes from the city of Ur, a Babylonian clay tablet, and it is the first registered customer complaint in human history. Okay, this is actually what you're seeing right here, and so it starts with this: "Tell a Nazir, Nani says." Okay, this is how the clay tablet starts. And then he says, "You put ingots," which are these little copper little pieces, "which were no good before my messenger, and said, if you want to take them, take them. If you do not want to take them, go away. Why do you take me for that? You treat me with such contempt. How have you treated me for that copper?" I mean, it's like this. I mean, this is a small section. It's like this portion here. But this is a really long, long letter and customer complaint. And it's all about the money that he felt he was wronged, and how he's like, he's going to have to make it right and give him a refund. He's showing up. And what I really enjoyed about this tablet is, have you ever written a letter angry? Or like sent a text message angry? I don't know about you, but like my grammar and spell check goes out the window, and I'm like about to crack my glass because I'm typing so hard because I'm so frustrated. And I was trying to imagine, how would I send an angry text if I'd had to chip it into stone? It's like, ting, 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 you know, and it's like, duh, you know, throwing it. And like, how many of those that, you know, and the poor guy who probably like actually like had to do this while the other guy's over there really angry, he's like, no, scratch that. And he's like, okay. You know, it's like, it was just funny for me because this is 4,000 years ago, and this could easily be something on an Amazon review for copper today. Because money creates attention. Money creates a challenge. And last week I left you with this picture image of the second largest reservoir in California, and how because of the lack of water coming in, it had completely was on the threshold of being down to 25% capacity. And that this was the second largest source of water for the state of California. And that were we to be people who started to manage our money instead of our money managing us and our lives, instead of if we started telling our money where to go instead of getting to the end of the month wondering where it went, that we could actually start to be people who look like this, which is that same spot on that lake. The difference is this is now, the other one was about a year ago. That in 1 year, because of what started to come in to this lake, it started to fill up again. And that now this lake is about 80% of its capacity. And there is a whole powerful kind of impact that's going to have downstream. That California's gotten so much water and snow that even this past week, an ancient lake was rediscovered. Because the water started filling in a place that had not been in so long. Now there was a lake forming where there had not been a lake before. And they realized, oh, this used to be a lake. It's just been so dry for so long that we forgot there was a lake here. And in some ways today, I want to challenge you that I'm going to probably make you more uncomfortable today in church than you've ever been. And so if this is your first time, I'm so glad you're here. It is all downhill from you from this point on, which is great, okay? Because I want us to look at some words when Jesus gave a money talk. It's some words that I think, like this reservoir, has some powerful downstream effects that can change not only our lives, but the lives of people it impacts. But there's a little bit of a disclaimer in this that is actually rooted in the money talk that Jesus first gave. So go ahead and turn down the heat a little bit if I just made you nervous. And it's that I want to talk about Jesus' money talk found in the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount is an interesting kind of name. It wasn't the name he gave it. It was the name that scholars gave it. It is the most studied speech in human history. More have been written about that speech than any other speech that's ever been given. I mean, it's insane. The number of words that have been written about the words that Jesus spoke almost 2,000 years ago. And that this original moment, though, wasn't so much a sermon on the mount. It wasn't like this, where Jesus gets up in front of a crowd and speaks to them, although there was a crowd there that day. The actual context for the Sermon on the Mount was Jesus had taken his disciples to a mountain, because Israel was and still is very hilly, and he had set up on top of this mountain with this beautiful kind of landscape around them out in nature, and he begins to teach his disciples, his followers, because they've started following him. They know he's a different kind of rabbi and that he's got a different type of spiritual teaching. And so he takes them to this mountain to continue to invest in them, to teach them, because he recognizes this is not your default. This is not what you already know. You have to teach. Like human beings, we're not like animals. We don't roll up into this world with certain instincts of knowing how to do things. We have to be taught and instructed. And so this is what Jesus is doing spiritually with these followers. And as he's teaching, a crowd begins to gather around and listen in. And this is where I think this is important. Because the crowd that's gathering around, they are curious about Jesus, but they're not following Jesus. To use our kind of parlance, our verbiage of the day, the crowd that's there are curious, but they're not Christian. They're listening in, like some of you. You got dragged here, or you came here, or you showed up today, and you're still on this kind of journey figuring out the spiritual thing and working through faith, and maybe you've got some baggage from how you grew up or what you were exposed to. And you're just kind of listening in. You're curious about this church. Your kids love this church, or you've seen the way that we invest in the community, and you're like, what's going on there? I want to know more. They're curious. And then there's the core, the Christians. They're listening because they want to live it. And this morning's message is one of those just kind of disclaimers that if you're curious about Christianity, if you're kind of not sure where you stand, you wouldn't label yourself a Christ follower, then today you get to listen in to one of, I think, Jesus' most profound teachings on money. And for those who of us who follow Christ, then you get to lean in and have your eyes elevated or have your life celebrated for how you're living. Because what he's about to say is not completely foreign to everyone in this room. Some of you, you live a life of generosity and you have kind of fully bought into what he's about to say. And today, this is about just reminding you what you're already doing for him. And to maybe, hopefully, that you would walk away from this message today with some words to be able to communicate it to the next generation so that they follow what you follow. And Jesus starts off with this in Matthew 6:19. He says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal." Like, this is how he jumps in. There's no funny story. There's no clay tablet. This is it. He's like, do not store up for yourself treasures on earth. He's immediately pivoted to talking about money. And he's recognizing by stating this, what's really obvious, but I think we have to be reminded, is that we all kind of, because of how we grew up and because of what you were taught, because what you saw and you caught from your parents, there is a default that you operate under. You may not think about it that way, but you have kind of a default operating system. The way you discipline your child, if you have kids, is a default that you probably caught or maybe were taught. How you manage your money is another one of these things. And he's like, look, the default for humans is to store up treasures on earth. The default for humans is to have a life that is more about consumption than it is generosity. Now, Americans, on the surface and in surveys, will say they're very generous. And like I shared last week from one of the studies, that Americans will overestimate their generosity. They usually double, percentage-wise, what they think they actually give in the course of a year. But because of these studies, what we know, because part of the study, one of the conditions is that they had to give access to their tax reports. And what they found is that most people doubly estimated their rate of generosity. They would say, oh, I'm so generous, I give 5%, and it was more like 1.5% to 2%. And so the kind of the default generosity level is 1%, 1.5% for Americans. Massachusetts is actually even less generous than the average American in other states, which is interesting when you kind of compare states and the generosity levels that each state has. But Jesus understands something about not just the default then, but the default with us. That the average American has about $6,000 in credit card debt, about $150,000 in kind of consumer debt total, right? The average American only has about 2 paychecks between them and bankruptcy. And yet, at the same time, that same average group, that we have over 23 million storage units in America that are at currently over 92-93% occupancy right now. So when Jesus says, do not store up your treasures, he's not just talking about that group. There is so much storage space in America that every single man, woman, and child in America has 6.1 square foot of storage space, that if you divided it all up, there would be enough for all of us to have 6.1 square feet of storage space. Like, his words almost 2,000 years ago ring eerily true today too. And that these people lived in homes about the size of our storage units. And this was a struggle. And now today, like, we have a home for the stuff that can't fit in our home. Right? And it's not a bad thing. But it is a thing that he's pointing out, because he's saying, hey, look, there's a default, and I want to elevate your default to a conscious level, because most defaults just exist underneath the surface. It's subconscious. We don't even think about how we do it. And so then he continues. He says, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. That's interesting. He's not condemning the storing up. Right? Notice this. He's like, but store up for yourselves. He's like, look, the impulse you have to store is good. It's just the where you're storing that's off. He's like, so instead of storing it here, store it in heaven, where moth and vermin and thieves, like, he's like, there's a better way, is what he's saying to his disciples. And what he's saying to us, there is a better way. And to connect the dot, because I don't want to just say, oh, treasures in heaven is generosity. I want to be very explicit. Paul takes this idea in 1 Timothy 6, verses 18 and 19, and he builds on it and expands it so that we have a direct connection. He says, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age. Paul directly connects the treasures in heaven moment that Jesus is saying to our generosity and how we live our life, how we spend our resources and our time. He's making it very explicit about storing up treasures for themselves. And Jesus is saying, hey, there is a fundamentally vast and different and better way to do this thing. That in this money talk that he begins to deliver, he starts to kind of split the path out and to say there's two different roads you can walk. You can live a life that is oriented around you, focused on storing up things here, Or you can live a life that's oriented about what flows out of you and what you do for others. You know, the Dead Sea, the reason it's called the Dead Sea is that the Dead Sea is unique in that water flows into it, but nothing flows out of it. And it's the same way about life. A life that has things that flow in, but it never flows out. There's no generosity. There's no giving. There's nothing that pours from it. Eventually ends up in a place of death. That sea in Israel today is a picture of what Jesus was trying to warn them about. So why is Jesus saying this? Why is he wanting to orient? Is it because he wants their stuff? Is it because Jesus wants what's in their storage units? Or is it even worse, is it because the preacher wants what's in your storage unit? No. He actually goes on. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. And if then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? See, Jesus has pivoted in this message. Right before this, he makes a statement that, for whatever reason, didn't show up in my slide. It was there at the run-through, but it didn't pop up here. But he says this. He says, where your treasure is, there your heart is. See, he wasn't after your treasure. He's not after my treasure. He just understands something. Like, hey, you. Come here. Yep, come here. Come. Yes, give him a hand of applause. So, can I have your wallet? Just for a minute, okay? Sweet, thank you. All right, you can sit down. You don't have to stand there. Okay? So, it's his wallet, right? Oh, Marriott. Sweet. You know, hey. Me and my wife have been looking to get away, and so I'm just saying, if there's some points on there, oh, you have dollar bills. Okay, yeah. Like, this will pay for the dinner when we go away, right? Isn't that awesome? And so what Jesus understood is the power our treasures have, okay? He understands something about the human experience. Now, Justin may have been listening, and he probably was because he's awesome like that. But I can tell you that Justin has probably never paid attention to the pants I am wearing more than he is currently paying attention to the pants I am wearing. And if I kept walking back and forth, he probably is going to be more engaged and in tune with me than he ever has before. And if I walked off the stage, he would be one of the first people to meet me, tell me how great a job I did, and ask for his wallet back. Because what Jesus understood about us is that one of the best ways to get to our heart, one of the best ways to get our attention, to get our focus, is to hold our treasure. That where your treasure is, there's your heart too. Right? Thank you. So, there you go. Okay, thank you. Jesus knew that the way to your heart was through your wallet. The way to your life was through your account. And he moves to this part, which seems really strange. All of a sudden, the eye is the lamp of the body, and your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. He's moved really quickly in his teaching on money to illustrate it. Because he wants them to understand, look, I'm after your heart because there's actually something else after your heart too. That this isn't neutral. That there's something dangerous at stake. About a year ago at the National Zoo, the zookeepers arrived to the flamingo exhibit. Now, there's about 79 flamingos at the National Zoo. Flamingos are fascinating, beautiful birds. But every single one of these birds had their wings clipped because the zoo didn't want them to escape. Now, it's been theorized that foxes have a instinctual ability, almost an algorithm in their brain, to notice when an animal's movement is unnatural. To notice if a bird is making a movement that would communicate it can't fly. And that night, based on the footage, what they see is a fox walking through the National Zoo and stop and notice a flamingo exhibit. Because the fox instinctively can recognize the unnatural movement of the 70-plus birds. And over the course of hours, that fox will chew away through a metal fence and create a hole big enough for it to climb in. And by the next morning, when the zookeepers arrive, a third of the flamingos are dead because of a fox that got in. Because none of those birds could escape. And what Jesus is doing in this moment with this crazy story about the eye and the lamp of the body and this strange turn is to say, you don't understand why I'm after your heart. It's because there's something else after your heart too. That there's this dangerous, insidious thing. And that what he understood about our spiritual growth, your spiritual maturity, is that there is no full way to follow Jesus and yet keep a small section of your life untouched by him. That there is no way you can walk in freedom. There is no way you can move with joy and peace and trust and life if we are keeping pockets of our lives at a distance from him and his desires. And one of the, as being a pastor for almost 20 years, I can tell you one of the most consistent areas that people in their spiritual journey keep away from God is this area around money. Because they believe this dangerous lie that creeps into their head that God's just after and wants to take from them and doesn't understand, they completely miss what God wants to do for them. He's not trying to rob us of enjoying nice things. He's not trying to get us to live in some squatter's hut, driving around in some dinky car or some Fred Flintstone car where we're self-powering it, woeing is us, wearing secondhand clothes, right? Like, he's not trying to take from us. He's trying to do something for us, and he understands that when our heart comes in full alignment with him, something is unleashed in us. But if we continue to move spiritually and we keep our money over here apart from our faith over here with him, we will never experience the spiritual life we were meant to experience. And I see it because there's something about the keystone habit of our finances because it's the quickest way to our heart. And Jesus is after our heart if we're following him, if you're a Christian. He wants who he is to flow into every area of your life. And yet, so often, we hide behind smoke screens and we allow this dangerous idea that I can live my life fully for God, but not fully in my finances. And eventually, that fox, that lie, spreads to other areas of our life. I'm not saying if you started giving to God today that all of a sudden your life's going to be perfect and all together and, you know, you're going to have blessing over blessing and you plant that seed and there's going to be a harvest that comes back. I'm not saying any of that. But I'm just saying as someone who has been giving generously for decades that I have never, ever regretted where I put that money. And I am convinced that so much of the goodness I've experienced in my life is downstream of that decision when I first started following Jesus to fully follow him in every area of my life, including my finances. Because there is nothing that I'm holding back from him. And it changes how I do relationships. It changes how I experience peace. It changes everything. And Jesus is talking to this group of his followers, and he's saying, look, here's what's at stake. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. It just doesn't work. Spiritually, it is not going to be successful. And you're never going to experience the promises to the level that it's promised if we don't give him access to every area of our life. Because you can't serve two masters. You can't serve God and money. And so he's unpacking this, and then he does another brilliant turn. So why is this serving God and money? Why is money hold such a special challenge for us in following Christ? Why do we co-sign the kindness and the love and co-sign the joy and the peace in my life, but not want to co-sign that in our finances? And it's because what he does next. He says, therefore, if you've ever taken our spiritual formation course called the 112, you'll know that there's two big principles I teach. Context is king, right? So I've been doing that. This original message, the context was two different groups of people, the core and the crowd. And that language is queen. The words that are chosen our own purpose. And when you see the word therefore, okay, that word holds a special connection. It's like back in the day, like conjunction, junction, what's your function? You know, like that. Okay. Anyways, like the whole whatever. Okay. But like conjunct, they hold, they put together, they connect. This is a connecting word. Therefore. Therefore, everything I've just said about money. Therefore. I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or what about your body, what you will wear. So he moves from money to money. But he's getting to why money holds this special temptation in our lives. It's because that money whispers to our worry that it can give us security. It whispers to our worry that it can erase all of our fears. I mean, the average American is convinced that if they just make a little bit more, they would be happier. But what's statistically been found is that past $75,000 a year, which probably should be adjusted for Massachusetts, but past $75,000 a year, okay, that the correlation of money and happiness begins to drop off drastically. That once you get to a point where your needs are met and even some of your wants begin to be met, money no longer brings the happiness it brought before. Because what it brought at first was security. And you need to understand, like, we don't even have a box for what it meant to be insecure financially back then. Because the food that grew that week was the food you consumed that week. I mean, we can go to Wegmans and eat cotton candy grapes that were grown in Mexico. And our biggest lament is that cotton candy grapes are only available certain times out of the year. Like, that's the closest we get to food insecurity. Because there's food just all around the world, food just sitting there waiting for us. Then we take the food there and we put it in our pantries so it can wait for us at our home more conveniently. Like, this was not a thing back then. We have so many clothes. We have clothes for doing one thing, and then we have clothes for doing another thing, and then we have clothes that we don't even wear, but we keep those clothes because one day we'll be small again or we'll be whatever again, and we're going to wear them. Like, we have rooms for our clothes. We call them closets. These people had one outfit, maybe two. So when he says, therefore, I tell you, do not worry, he's speaking to a whole different category of worry. And he's saying, look, I know money whispers security. And that's the temptation for your heart. He's like, but I say, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. So now he's driving to the heart of the matter. He's like, look, I am your provider. Like, what I recognize is that in every job I've ever owned or held, it is not the paycheck that provides my security. It is God using that paycheck to channel security to me. That when we sit down at dinner as a family to pray, one of the things that I will pray, one of the things when I pray with my daughter at night, one of the things I explicitly will say is I will connect the dots for her and let her know that it is not this church that provides for our family. It is God who provides for our family through this church. And that's a really big difference, because if I think it's this church, then I would never do this talk, because I'd be afraid of what you would do in response to me saying you should be giving. But my security is not wrapped up in this church. My security comes from the Father through this church. It's why, yes, you can clap. It's why if you ever walk through a moment of unemployment, as terrifying it is, I think it is a moment where your faith can shine. Because everyone else around you is losing their mind because their security just got taken from them. And you can walk out with your head held high saying, my security is still there. It's just a question of where he's going to bring it, not if he's going to bring it. Like, this is a different way of living. And this is what he wants for you and for me, because when we start to walk with that assurance and that confidence, it changes how we live. It changes how we give. It changes our life. Because I want my daughter to know that her provision that comes from her parents is not coming from her parents. It's coming from God. Because when she's 30 and she's working out her life and her story, I want her to realize who is providing is more important than what that provision's coming through, so that she can be unshaken by what life tries to do. And the generosity of God, honestly, is that he realizes that all money is ultimately a faith journey anyway. Money, maybe you've never thought about it this way, but the last few weeks in America, we have not had a money crisis with a handful of banks. We've had a trust crisis. We've had a faith crisis. That's why people ran to those banks, because they lost trust in them. They lost faith in them. Money always will posture itself either as a good tool or as a god. It will be an object in which you express your faith, or it will become an object of faith. And Jesus understood that. And this is why he teaches that. But notice he says, for the pagans run after all these things, which is interesting. Pagans, Jesus again, remember, he's drawing this two parallel path. He's like, here's how I want to call you into living. And then he reminds them, like, hey, all of this is what the pagans do. And pagans, this big catch-all word. He's essentially saying, there are a group of people who do not believe what you believe. And what they do is they behave in a way that reflects their beliefs. He's like, but for you, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all of these things will be given to you as well. It's like the pagans have a set of beliefs and they behave in accordance with that. And the challenge for us as Christians following Jesus is that if we're not careful, we can believe like Christians and behave like pagans when it comes to our finances. Let me give you the questions Jesus was asking. He says, do you believe Jesus is your hope in this life and the next? If you're a Christian, yes, that's your answer. Do you believe what you will do in this life will echo into eternity? Yes. Does your money reflect that belief? That's what he's saying. Does your money, because this is called money talks, because money does. Money is saying something. And does your money, does my money, say what I believe? Or do I live in this very abstract, ambiguous place of being a practical atheist? He's like, does your money reflect that belief? The pagans, they're pretty consistent. Their beliefs, their behaviors line up. How about yours? And that, when I said at the very beginning, this was going to be a very challenging talk. It was challenging then, and it's challenging now. Because he's speaking to a group of people who've grown up, and their definition of generosity, you have to understand, is probably way more generous than even what an average American's definition of generosity is. To be Jewish meant that when you thought about generosity, you believed in this concept called a first fruit tithe, which was that 10% of what you received, you brought to God. And Jesus is speaking to a people whose default is 10%. Not the 1% that we have as Americans. And he's calling them to a whole different lifestyle. And the challenge, I sincerely wrestled through this message because my fear was that you would just hear, the church wants my money. And that you would use that as a smokescreen to not hear what God is saying to you, that he wants your heart and he wants your whole life. And that you can miss the most important part about it, that ultimately, I sat in my car last night. I really, really wrestled with this message. Because I know that, man, if every person that calls this church home started giving whatever that was in line with Christian generosity, it would not change my paycheck. It wouldn't change our family and how our family lived. And ultimately, I was like, you know what? The reason I decided to do this is because I understand something, and it's the reason I take what I get to do as such a holy privilege of being your spiritual leader. So one of, this is a guy I've talked about before. His name is Dr. Milne. And Dr. Milne was probably one of the greatest gifts I ever got in life. I became a Christian in college. August 7th, 2001 is when I first started following Jesus. And shortly after, I met him. And he took me to lunch. And we sat there for hours. And he just kept asking me questions about my story. And then at the end of it, because we sat there for so long, he reached into his wallet and in a full Justin style, pulled out a significant figure and placed it on the table and said, we've taken this woman's table for the last 2 or 3 hours. We want to make sure that we bless her, not rob from her. And he put more money on the table for that woman than I could have pulled out of my bank account. And he said, how would you like to do this regularly? And I'm like, can I just be your waiter? And so we would meet every Wednesday morning at 6:30 a.m. And the reason 6:30 a.m. is because he was one of the best eye surgeons in the world. Like, no joke. The country of China flew him in to teach their doctors a cataract procedure that he invented, that he had the patent to, that revolutionized cataract surgeries. And he was literally one of the best in the world. And he would meet with me as a grad student every Wednesday morning at this breakfast restaurant. He would talk about life, and he would just open up his life. And one of the areas he opened up that I'm so grateful for was the area of finance. And he talked about money. He talked about giving. He shared his dream was to give 90% of what he made away and live on the 10%. That's what he wanted to angle to. Now, Dr. Milne had one of the nicest houses in the entire area on this beautiful lake sitting at the very edge. He drove a car that he'd literally had transferred over from Europe because you couldn't even buy it in America. He lived a really nice life. He enjoyed life. And I think the reason he can enjoy his nice car, his nice house, his country club membership was because his stuff did not have him. Because he kept investing in my family. He kept investing in me. And then when I met Jenny and we get engaged, he hosts our rehearsal dinner because I didn't have a father. And he says, a father pays for a child's rehearsal dinner. And he asks me my favorite restaurant and my favorite food. And I tell him, and he literally shuts the restaurant down and has the restaurant come out to his house. And he turns his house into a restaurant that serves the meal to us and gives me LASIK eye surgery as a wedding gift. He's radically generous. And then he gets cancer. And within a couple years of getting cancer and thinking he survived, I end up being in the hospital room with him, telling him thank you as he took his last breath. But here's the thing about him. That in all of this message that you have to understand that Jesus understood. Is that day when he was breathing his last breath and I was holding his hand and I was telling him how grateful I was for him in my life. I was not talking about me. I was talking about all the people downstream of me. My son is named Henry because his first name was Henry. I was like, my wife sees him every single day. My kids get him every single day because of his generosity. What we can miss with generosity is it is not about what God wants to take from you. It is about what God wants to do through you. Because when you say no to generosity, the tragic part, the piece that made me say there is no way I cannot talk about this, is because on the other side of your generosity is stories that you can't even predict right now. Every time you've ever gotten in the car and your kid has talked about this church, every time your kid finally figured out what to do with that bully because they were sitting in elementary and they were working through that series, or every time you've ever walked away from a community event, or every time you've walked away from a message inspired, you are downstream of his generosity. You are living in the overflow of his life. And what's on the other side of you saying yes to generosity is the downflow and the overflow of lives that will be transformed. And some of the people sitting beside you in this room and listening online, they already know that. And they're the people that I celebrate. Because I recognize the reason why I wanted to do this is that when life is all stripped away, my prayer for all of us is that when the name of Jesus becomes a face of Jesus, that you will not feel regret, that you will experience reward. Because when I walked away from the hospital room that day and I got in my car and I cried my eyes out because I lost him, there was this moment of joy that rushed over my life where I was like, oh my goodness, I know what's happening in heaven right now. Well done, good and faithful servant, was being said over him. And I so desperately, I don't care if you ever like me. What I care is that when you see him, you will look like him. That when you see him, that it will be a moment of reward for you, not regret. Because I think when we stand before him, if we haven't lived our lives like him, like biblical generosity, that all the stuff that we wasted in our lives, will be a source of regret. All those things that we built up. If you have kids, here's the crazy thing. We build up so much stuff, and then we pass them on. And then if you've ever been on the other side, you know what happens. When somebody walks into your house after you died, you're like, what do we do with all this junk? Most of the stuff that you and I adore, that you and I just slaved for, so proud of, our kids are going to give away or throw away. And, no offense, but if you happen to have a dumb child, all it takes is one dumb child to waste all the stuff that you built your entire life to build up. And what Jesus was saying to his disciples and what I experienced through his life is there is a way of living your life that no dumb child can wreck. That has downstream effects that will change the world. And so you may say, okay, how? And he said, but seek first his kingdom. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will follow. And so here's how I want to close. I want to give you a challenge. For some of you who follow Jesus and you've never leaned in to this generosity portion of your faith, you've tipped God, you've reactionarily given, but you've never leaned in to this generosity thing. The answer to how happens here. Seek first. See, the idea of this first fruit tithe concept was to give to him first, because he understood that that decision had a downstream effect with all the other decisions in life. Practically speaking, our family, we give first to him, and then the rest of our budget falls in a line with that number. Because if I wait to give to him the leftovers, I will never, ever have any leftover that is going to make a difference and that will overflow downstream the way it was meant to. And so the seek first. And so here's the challenge. Call it the two-month challenge. Make it a little bit easier for you. Is if you've never stepped into generosity, and here's how I define generosity. I personally think the 10% is the standard. And that what Jesus does is actually go beyond that. That's what our family does. It's full transparency. Being the pastor, I don't get a pass on that. I get to give. I'm a Christian first. Okay? It just means the church gets a good deal because they can claim to give me a salary, but it's really cut because I'm going to give it right back. I mean, imagine if you had employees and they were giving back a portion, a significant portion of their check. You'd be like, man, these are my favorite employees, right? I mean, this is just the way it's set up. And this is, it's over 2%, and it's somewhere north of that. So if you're like, I don't know about the 10%, I haven't worked that out, that's fine. Come in north of 2. Whatever generosity looks like. And over the next 2 months, step into that. Reorient your life around that. Give. Does it mean you'll probably have to cut out something? Yes. But does it mean that there's going to be something even more significant? Because I love tax time, because it's the time that I get the giving statement from Encounter Church, and I see how much we gave. And I've never, in the course of all my life, ever looked at that number and regretted what I gave to the church. It's honestly the best investment I ever made in all of my years. And some of you are already awakened to that. And your two-month challenge is simply this. I want to challenge you. If you're one of those people, you are fully in line with this generosity thing, to take the next 2 months and be intentional about passing down that generosity to your kids. Having the conversation to the people that you have influence over about what generosity really is. Say, hey, did you know that I give 10%? Did you know I give whatever percent to the church? And here's why. Because God gave his son for me. It's my gift to give back to him. To make sure you pass it down to your kids or to the people you have influence. For the rest of you, to step in to step up, maybe for some who've been tipping God, to actually start to move into a place where it starts to make a difference in generosity and the fuller picture of that word and what Jesus was casting vision for, and to lean in. And for some of you, maybe you're wanting to practice generosity, but life and schedule gets in the way. And maybe for you, it's just using the app and setting up something automated. But just do it for 2 months. Like I said, you're not going to come back next week, and I'm going to be wearing a silk suit or driving some nice car or talking about my private jet. Because first of all, if you all gave, ain't no way that's going to happen, okay? So let's just kind of downscale what private jets cost, because clearly we don't have a clue, right? My paycheck's not going to change. What will change is the amount of good that we can do. What will change, what you will get to be a part of, is that there are people who've already stepped into generosity as a lifestyle, and I know that when they stand before Jesus, the kids that leave this church, the families that were restored, the addictions that were broken, the lives that were transformed for eternity, the chains that were broken, that will be part of their reward. They will see that storyline flash before their eyes. They will see the storylines of people who show up at the egg drop, and then at some point down the road, we end up baptizing, and their life is different. Like, that's their reward. That's your reward if you're already living it. And I want desperately for the rest of you to experience that. So much that if the reason you can't do it is because you're not sure you trust this church, then leave this church and find a church that you can trust. I care more about your soul than I care about what you give to this church. I care more about the moment when you see Jesus than me not seeing you again. Because that matters. Find a place that you can trust and give and lean in. Step in. Step up. Because at the end of the day, I think these two things capture what our life's going to look like. You're either going to be this guy who's forever remembered as being a sneaky, conniving, little tightwad who one day regretted what he did. Or you'll be this guy who's currently in the presence of Jesus, whose life of generosity is continuing to reap benefits on this side and the next through your lives and through the lives of your kids. And let's, as a church, decide that our money, when it talks, is going to say that. Let's pray. Father, thank you for grace and for mercy that Jesus, your sacrifice was the example that paints the picture for us to live. Thank you for your call to generosity. Thank you for the why, the what, and the how. And I pray that we as a church would rise to that so that we could overflow in what you desire to do through us. Because you're worthy of that, Jesus. So in our final moments, Lord, may you help us to settle what we need.